while he didn't himself have perhaps ambitions to have power in North Korea, he did still present a threat to Kim Jong-un's hold on power.
Authorities continue to piece together the death of Kim Jong-un's half-brother. It's Thursday, February 16th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Log on right now for more on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, elections in Jakarta may go to a runoff. India sends a record number of satellites to space. China's growing economy and robots on display. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The half-brother of North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un died in Malaysia in what South Korea called an assassination orchestrated by the regime in Pyongyang. Malaysian authorities detained a woman from Myanmar for questioning and are investigating the death of Kim Jong-nam, at one time considered an heir to the late North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il and the father of both Kims, whose birthday will be celebrated in North Korea Thursday. It is seen as the highest profile death since the execution of Kim Jong-un's uncle more than 3 years ago, one of a number of executions since he came to power in late 2011. South Korea's intelligence agency said Kim Jong-nam, who had mostly lived in Macau under Chinese protection, had been a target of assassination for years. Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stangerone tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Kim Jong-nam, while on record opposing North Korea's dynastic rule, was not a strong critic of his half-brother.
Kim Jong-nam, while he was opposed to hereditary succession in North Korea, he had also said that he hoped his brother did well for the people of North Korea, so he didn't necessarily put it, we'll say, a way that was perhaps too negative to Kim Jong-un. But he'd also never really expressed any desire or intention to potentially challenge Kim Jong-un for power in North Korea. In that sense, it's a little surprising that this would occur. The one thing that I think we can consider here is that if there were ever a time to where China were to decide to try and engage in regime change in North Korea itself, Kim Jong-nam would be the one individual who might be able to take and unite the different families in North Korea and hold leadership as a potential figurehead. So while he didn't himself have perhaps ambitions to have power in North Korea, he did still present a threat to Kim Jong-un's hold on power.
North Korea, of course, has undergone purges since Kim Jong-un came to power. Is this just another case of this? Does this signify an instability in the regime?
It could potentially signify instability if the North Koreans thought that there was something going on, either that Kim Jong-nam had changed his mind about trying to gain power and perhaps reached out to some potential allies in North Korea. There aren't any indications of that, but if they thought that was the case, this would be a purge. Or this simply could be something along the lines that they saw an opportunity to eliminate a potential future threat, and they took that opportunity.
Asan Institute for Policy Studies research fellow James Kim said South Korea's prime minister called a Security Council meeting Wednesday in the wake of the news.
Any kind of development that shows some sort of change or movement within the leadership in Pyongyang is cause for concern and something that I guess the leadership in South Korea needed to gather more information and also talk about what all these changes mean.
Is there any doubt in South Korea that he was assassinated, or is there doubt?
Well, there's a strong possibility. I don't think there's much doubt here. What this suggests is that there are limits in terms of options that the elites in North Korea may have should something happen to Kim Jong-un. I think the same can be said for the elites in China, the leadership in Beijing. They had Kim Jong-nam as a potential option. That option is no longer existent.
Does this tell you anything about the state of the North Korean regime and its hold on power?
I think what it says is that Kim Jong-un is further consolidating his power. It's an interesting turn of events. And what it suggests is that Kim Jong-un has further consolidated and that he can make these kinds of bold moves is a sign that his power is, in fact, growing.
North Korea has a long history of assassination attempts, mostly of South Korean officials, dating to the 1960s. Meanwhile, the North Korean Foreign Ministry Wednesday rejected Monday's UN Security Council condemnation of its latest ballistic missile test, insisting that Sunday's launch was a sovereign right and a self-defense measure. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Aid groups in North Korea struggle amid nuclear tension. Deadly Philippine drug war takes gentler turn for now. Taliban bombs and kills 6 people in Pakistan. China lodges protest with India over visit by Taiwan legislators. Sold into marriage, how Rohingya girls become child brides in Malaysia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A quick count of Wednesday's election to select the governor of Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, indicates that the race will go to a second round of voting in April. The surveys show that the incumbent, Basuki Ahok Tahiyatha Purnama, ahead with just over 40% of the vote. Anies Baswedan was a few percentage points behind in second place, while Agus Harimurti Yudhoyono was in third with about 15%. The official results are not due until February 27th.
Candidate Agus Harimurti Yudhoyono was an army major until he resigned to enter the gubernatorial race in Jakarta. The son of former President Yudhoyono, he is a career military but assured voters he is ready to be the next governor.
I am for Agus and Bu Silvi because, first of all, they are clean.
Candidate Basuki Cahaya Purnama is the incumbent governor. He's been recognized for making Jakarta cleaner, solving the problem of annual floods, and improving public transit. But he's outspoken, which many people don't like, and he's facing an ongoing trial in an alleged blasphemy case.
Honestly, I'm for Pak Ahok because he's courageous, firm, and honest. It has been proven compared with previous governors.
The third candidate is Anies Baswedan, an academician and former Minister of Education in the Jokowi administration.
Of course I support Anies because of his track record. He is clean.
Siti Zuro, a senior analyst with the Indonesian Institute of Sciences, LIPI, says the candidate's relative youth, they're between 38 and 50, has sparked interest in the election among youth voters. Siti Zuro describes the advantages and the disadvantages of each of the candidates.
Candidate Agus Yudhoyono, a Javanese, and his running mate, Silviana Murni, a woman and who is also a bureaucrat of Betawi ethnicity, was born and grew up in Jakarta. Their candidacy has drawn a special enthusiasm from supporters. Incumbent Basuki Cahaya Purnama is well-liked, but the controversy over his alleged blasphemy has decreased his support. Polls show he's dropped from over 50% to 30%. The third candidate, Anies Baswedan, appeals to young netizens who are first-time voters. They think he is cool and friendly. But voters in Jakarta, while rational, are also fickle.
Philips Ramanti of the Indonesian CSIS said surveys or public polls on electability of the candidates could not establish the general trend of the election results.
There are two kinds of voters. Retrospective voters whose questions to the candidate is, what have you done so far? And there's the so-called prospective voters who ask, what are you going to do? So the election may depend on the credibility of the promises of each candidate. I think February 15th's election is interesting because the various results of the surveys showed voters' preferences have not been established.
Fermanti says Jakarta gubernatorial election is important for Indonesia as a whole because what happens in Jakarta could influence the general political situation of the nation.
For the past few months, many people are concerned because old issues have resurfaced, especially on relations between the country and religion, or citizens' right to be elected or to vote, pluralism, etc. Religious issue in this election has created frictions that have made the capital seems to be more intolerant than any other parts of Indonesia. Therefore, I think the success of the February 15th gubernatorial election is a test not only for Jakarta's voters, but also for Indonesia.
For the past 4 months, since the first day of the incumbent's blasphemy trial, thousands of Muslim protesters have gathered in Jakarta from many parts of Indonesia, demanding a guilty verdict and jail. They're angry that Purnama is legally allowed to campaign for re-election. Indonesia, a democratic country, has the largest Muslim population in the world. Would the religion factor influence the outcome of the elections? Again, Philips Vermonti.
rational.
Religious factors exist in the public mind, but I think what we are seeing probably is more of an elite-based conflict. I am confident that our people generally are still moderate, as evidence shows that in other 100 regional elections, the issue of religion is non-existent. But conservatism elements have been mobilized by the elite groups, and religious or anti-ethnic issues are the easiest tool to use.
Given the divisiveness of the elections, it remains to be seen whether the results of the elections would have positive effect on the country. From Washington, D.C., VOA.
Happening now in Asia, seven Hong Kong police officers were convicted of assaulting a protester during pro-democracy demonstrations in 2014. All of the defendants faced one joint count of causing grievous bodily harm with intent, but in the end, the city's court convicted them with a lesser charge of assault. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us today on VOA Asia. An Indian rocket blasted off early Wednesday from eastern India, and it put a record 104 satellites into space in a single launch. India's space agency says the mission surpasses Russia's previous feat of launching 37 satellites just a year ago. The launch also marked a milestone in the country's efforts to emerge as a serious contender in the multi-billion-dollar global commercial space industry by slashing costs. Besides a 714-kilogram Earth observation satellite, the other satellites were mostly nano-satellites weighing up to 10 kilograms each. A majority of these small satellites came from customers in the United States, others from countries such as Kazakhstan, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates. The nationally televised launch showed scientists applauding successive stages in the mission control room. India's space program has focused heavily on low-cost access to space. Rajeswari Pillai Rajagopalan, a space analyst from New Delhi's Observer Research Foundation, says the ability to put a larger number of satellites in space in a single launch brings down the cost significantly, which could help the country grab a larger slice of the commercial launch market.
You know, doing record-breaking launches in one go kind of does clearly highlight India's advancement as well as the sophistication to do a lot more maneuvering in its space program, in a sense. So a lot many more countries could be approaching India to do their own space launches and so on and so forth.
India's ambitious space program got international attention after a successful mission to Mars in 2014, which had a price tag of $74 million compared to the hefty $670 million outlay of NASA's Mars mission a few months later. And it was hailed as an indication that its frugal space program has achieved technological prowess.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News alert from VOA Asia. China may consider revising its maritime safety law to require foreign submersibles to travel on the surface, raise their national flag, and report to Chinese maritime management administrations. China says the proposed changes are based on the UN Convention on Law of the Sea. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. As we continue with VOA Asia, some economists are projecting China's economy to grow at a pace that would, in just a few short years, become the world's largest. Others aren't so certain because of a number of factors. VOA Vietnamese reporter Tra My spoke to some economists about this.
A report came out last week by PricewaterhouseCoopers saying that China would take over the U.S. as the world's number one economy by 2030. And then India will take the second place, followed by the U.S., and Indonesia will rank fourth. According to that survey, the world economy could be more than double by size by 2050 due to technology-driven improvements. And they say that emerging markets led by China would grow twice as fast as advanced economies right now. As a result, six of the seven largest economies led by China will be taking over the advanced economies. With that forecast, I have talked to Vu Quang Viet, a renowned economist and former statistics expert with United Nations, and he's now working as a consultant for several international institutions, including African Development Bank. He said that, however, China cannot replace the U.S. in leading the world economy because developing economy must be based on innovations and technology and science. People in China is lacking access to, you know, free press and, you know, the lack of freedom in expressing their mind. And that would be an obstacle to innovations. He questioned that how could China play the role with such background? He went on and said, if everything is as smooth as right now, you know, without any crisis, big crisis taking place, China may be taking over the U.S., but it's not as soon as by 2030 as projected, but it could be like 2040 or 2050.
2030, I mean, it sounds like it's a long way away, but it's only 13 years from now.
Yes.
So yeah, with a lot would have to happen for China to really overtake the United States.
Right. And with the lack in their backgrounds, as said, you know, it would take them some time to build up their own might. According to this expert, China is trying to expand its influence from Asia to Africa. They're trying to take over control of those resources from, you know, oil to mines to natural resources. So the more they expand, the more dangerous in terms of the people around the world. You know, people can come up, as he suggests, can come up and say, you know, we don't want you to be here with those kind of investment and expansion. We want you to be here to fair play and, you know, to help us grow up and develop and things like that.
So more people, of a cooperative benefit as opposed to just an investment for their own gain.
Yes. And he said that the people right now, he's seeing that people in Africa are taking down the street, protesting against China's presence. Over there. In Vietnam, the same thing happened when China was trying to take over Vietnam's land for their mines like bauxite and, you know, some other kind of resources as well. People took the streets to express their anger.
Tra Mi from our Vietnamese service, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Developing at this hour in Asia, a government-appointed fact-finding commission in Myanmar's Rakhine State denied that crimes against humanity and genocide took place as outlined in a United Nations report. The report alleged that Myanmar security forces killed, raped, and committed other abuses against Rohingya Muslims. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, you know, it's hard to believe that almost 100 years ago, the word robot was first coined by Czech playwright Karel Čapek. But even more amazing, robots have been around in some form for 500 years or more. VOA's Deborah Block has more on the opening of a robots exhibit at London's Science Museum. It traces the mechanical technology that was in place over the past five centuries.
They're high-tech, futuristic, straight out of science fiction. But the robots that capture the most attention resemble humans.
We think that humanoid robots are this brilliant combination of hubris and science and technology, but also a healthy dose of egocentricity, creating these machine things in our image.
The more than 100 robots on display include this 1957 humanoid robot and this elegant silver swan, created in 1773. This clock, built in 1596, helped trigger ideas about the human body as a machine, leading to the creation of the first robots.
robots themselves have existed as automated beings that are capable of being programmed for many, many hundreds of years. We begin the story at the Science Museum 500 years ago, which is when we have our earliest artifacts on display. But really, in literature and archives, you see evidence of robots going even further beyond that.
Human fears and misgivings are often reflected by the robots seen in movies and pop culture.
A lot of the science fiction robots that we create are very malevolent characters because they're personifying these anxieties that we have about the future.
But those human-like robots will likely remain science fiction for a while longer.
The most advanced learning robot that we have on gallery is actually called the iCub, and that has the intelligence of a 5-year-old child. So after the 5 centuries of investigation and research and development, this is how far we've come.
Much of the focus on the future of robots is factory automation, or helping humans with a variety of tasks.
You'll never guess what Jamie said this morning.
To make their lives easier. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And this is one of the great stories that you can find on voanews.com in video format. That's right, you can see this story by going on our website. A fascinating story about the history of robots. Imagine that, 500 years in the making, and they're only getting more complex and more interesting as we go along. Well, always interesting are our listeners, and we thank everybody who's been joining us from Myanmar via the VOA Burmese Facebook page. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And we're also available on several of our VOA Language Service pages now. We'd like to hear from you. Write to us. Send us audio or video. You can message us in a number of ways. We want to know what you're doing and what your part of the world is like. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Follow us on our own Facebook page at VOA Asia. And we're also on Twitter. You can follow me at VOA Stevenson. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our great VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman, Anying Guo, and Michelia Cheatham. Welcome, Michelia, to our team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.